Hello, and welcome to Culture Shocking Stories, the podcast about telling stories from around the world. Here, we take the deep dive into the unique features and challenges that come with telling fiction in culturally specific ways. In today's episode, I will be interviewing Kenan Orhan, a Turkish-American author who has won the O. Henry Prize and was published in the 2022 edition of the Best American Short Stories. His many works focus on contemporary Turkey and the strangeness the individual faces living under its politics, the subject of which revolves around a country most English-speaking readers will have little understanding of or care for, which of course begs the question, what makes his stories tick? Let's find out. Once again, thank you so much for showing up. I tried to get so many people, and the thing with authors is that they're all hidden behind a row of publicists and agents, and you're the only one who I could get a direct link to. So thank you very much. Welcome to my podcast. This podcast, I suppose, is basically exploring sort of multicultural storytelling. I know that obviously a lot of your stories are set in Turkey and in Istanbul specifically, and there's definitely obviously cultural ties to those places, right? Mm-hmm. One of my main questions is, because you do write in English, do you ever find it difficult to write about a country that in English, when most English readers that are going to be reading these pieces are not going to have as much of a connection or care or just an understanding of the place that you're writing about as much as you do? Do you ever find that there's difficulty there?
Yeah, I would say right now, especially, I think in the last couple of weeks, actually, so it's very at the front of my mind right now, very kind of coincidental that you ask about it. I find myself writing stories that feel more like they're in translation than, you know, kind of writing about a Turkish American experience, which I think would probably be a lot more relatable for a lot of the audience, just because, not that my audience would then only be Turkish American immigrants or kind of children of immigrants, but I think I wouldn't say there's an overarching general application of what it feels like to be an immigrant in the United States, but there are some kind of overlaps between different immigrant groups. But I am very specifically writing about Turks in Turkey rather than Turks here. And I am finding that it is actually much more difficult to get an audience than I had anticipated. And it's a bit of a shame. I think that when you explore what it is to be a person somewhere outside of your own experience, you grow into a much larger world and find significantly more things in common with other people than you might have thought. You know,
right, yeah.
You can grow up in completely different experiences or different privileges, but mm-hmm. we as a whole, I think, I'm one of those people that believes that people have more in common than they have different. And I think the best way to highlight that is to actually get a human experience that people aren't used to and show them that it is actually very similar.
Yeah, and I understand that perfectly. As an immigrant myself, I do definitely relate to a lot of your stories. But do you think, like, how do you manage the little difference? I know you said that it's more difficult than you expected. Do you have any strong ideas about how you would bridge that gap, essentially? Because it is definitely true that human experiences are more or less universal, right? But I think just like the way mm-hmm. the setting is, that it is in such a different place. With, I don't know, it's not necessarily different sensibilities, but definitely just like even the little things, are going to be different. The politics and the way things are. Do you have any ideas about that?
So I actually kind of lean into the politics as the more relatable thing. I have found that, just because I think kind of globally we're seeing a investment in populism, in nationalism, in xenophobia, and in authoritarianism. And I think those transcend geographic boundaries.
I was reading the one where the man kills the three daughters, the one you wrote, and the description of the tear gas, that is relatable. I definitely see what you have there.
You don't have to travel very far to find tear gas, I think, globally, and just in the European kind of, I know, right? That's not like a thing we should be celebrating as a universal experience, but it is, unfortunately. In Europe, you've got kind of the Polish leader, the Hungarian leader, the Turkish leader. You have strong movements in Germany, in France, in England, all kind of pushing very similar political rhetoric. You have, I think, in the United States, people pushing similar political rhetoric. And then you have, you know, you're talking about China, you can talk about Russia, you can talk about kind of this ultra Islamophobia going on in India right now. It's an unfortunately more universal experience than I think people realize. And so I like to play a little bit with what sets Turkey apart from the United States and what makes it similar. And I think a culture of protest and then putting down protest, cracking down on protest, especially when you look at like the civil rights movement in the South, kind of historically, they share a lot there. And I think what talking about it in a different country does, though, creates kind of a leveling or a re-weirding of it from the American mindset, so that you have to approach kind of the political content anew. And that's also actually why I kind of enjoy writing these semi-surreal stories, because when you bring in an absurdism, a fabulism, a surrealism, it creates kind of this level playing field for the reader. We might not all know exactly what it means to kind of feel oppressed, but if you kind of introduce something that reduces humanity down to its bare essentials, it's easier for the reader to enter that. And so I think actually setting political concerns that exist in the United States in Turkey makes a U.S. reader perhaps more aware of the political ironies in their own existence.
Yeah. A lot of your stories are about small rebellions. The idea of small rebellions, I feel like, almost go antithetically with the protest culture here in the U.S., which is all about big things and we're going to go out in there and demonstrate, right? Do you find that to be an issue at all? Or do you think that is like you can find the connection there that Americans also do these small rebellions?
I think we kind of do. I know that my experience of kind of American protest culture or political awareness is more like, you know, you have to celebrate something, so you have to do a mass demonstration. And mass demonstration exists in Turkey as well. It's just the small rebellions are, I think, more common as oppression ratchets up, as authoritarian grows. And I wouldn't say that America exists as an authoritarian state overtly. And so that kind of under the surface authoritarianism doesn't necessitate the small rebellion, because we allow a culture that can do the big catharsis of a protest. And so I do think that it is a little bit different, but, you know, just it can feel so incredibly helpless, I think, in the States as well, regardless of what we're allowed to protest, because, you know, we look at saying, okay, we want to address climate change and I'm doing my part, I'm recycling, but like me putting 6 aluminum cans in a bin is not doing anything if I can't stop ExxonMobil from doing what it's doing, can't stop Shell from doing what it's doing. And so it is a small rebellion. And we don't think of them as small rebellions here. We think of them as us doing our civic duty. Mm-hmm. But it's sending a marshmallow against a bonfire, the recycling. I'm not like against it. I think we should continue.
It's a good idea. It's just also without the big, massive
political change, it doesn't really matter, our small rebellions. But that's the other thing, is who do you want to be? Right. Do you want to be the person that resigns themselves to hopelessness and say, well, I'm not going to recycle because it doesn't matter? Or are you going, and I think this is where my characters kind of live in, they don't have a choice. They're in a hopeless situation, but they're like, what am I going to do? Stop waking up?
And now a word from our sponsor, HelloFresh. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. It delivers farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients right to your doorstep, and it also delivers seasonal recipes along with it. So save a trip to the grocery store and say hello to a stressless holiday season with HelloFresh. And of course, with over more than 45 recipes and more than 100 add-on items, it is easier than ever to find something you will enjoy in the meal kits. Now, as a college student, I know the hassle it is to try to find new recipes to cook, as well as buying all the things in grocery stores with the long lines. With HelloFresh, I get my meals quickly and I get it without as much need to plan everything out. And I could use all that other time to do schoolwork, to do work, and to just gain general peace of mind. So go to HelloFresh.com/CLNSfree and use code CLNSfree for a free breakfast for life. One breakfast item per box while subscription is active. That's free breakfast for life at HelloFresh.com/CLNSfree with code CLNSfree. And now back to the show. I mean, obviously it's not like limited specifically to turkey, but it actually brings it to a different point, which is, do you adopt any storytelling conventions or even just basic attitudes that you think are more Turkish specific, or at least something like that?
I think mostly just because Turkish politics, as relatable and as universal as kind of contemporary political issues are for the human experience, I think Turkish politics are in a really strange, singular place. Just like really briefly, the history of the Turkish Republic is a secular state in a very not secular area, a democratic state in a very traditionally not democratic area, even though their first president was a one-party dictator who ruled until he died. But he's like considered the hero of democracy. And it's like, well, that seems paradoxical. Mm-hmm. And also he was vehemently atheistic, and to the point where he was like, we have to make a secular state, you know, being Islamic is bad, even though most of the country was Muslim at the time. So it exists as this paradox more than in other places. You can have kind of these ultra-nationalists who are very secular partnering up with these ultra-nationalists who are very religious, but you don't think of that in the States. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't really imagine secular and ultra-conservative religious parties working together here.
Right. Do you feel like then that this contradiction, because it's obviously brewing out of the whole history of it in the 20th century, do you think that the contemporary culture of Turkey is a more massive influence on not just you, but Turkish writers in general than it would be like the history of
Turkey? I think very contemporary kind of Turkish history, the development since the Republic has really formed contemporary Turkish fiction, especially out of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, when it was at the forefront of everybody's mind, contemporary politics was. Back in kind of years of turmoil, when there was like a decade of political unrest, coups, violence. And I think a lot of Turkish writers that I'm aware of that I read like to play with kind of the historical traditions that are holdovers from the Ottoman Empire, but also are working in this new sort of social realism that actually is much more similar to the Italian neorealism in film, the Italian social realism, as well as the Soviet social realism because of communism's influence in Turkey during the Cold War. Even though they were NATO and they weren't communist, there was a lot of
the whole missile crisis in Turkey.
But it has very much influenced the demeanor of my characters. They're not going to sit there. I have Islamophobic characters because there are Islamophobic Turks, but they're Islamophobic in a very different way. I find Islamophobia here in the States. It's a significantly more resentful because they are themselves Muslim, even though they're not practicing, or they're atheist now.
They're like steep in the tradition of it still. It's like you're like Christian in name, but like you still go to Christmas.
Because it is a majority Muslim country. So it's not a minority like it is here. Islamophobia in an Islam minority country means something different than Islamophobia in an Islam majority country. And so small things like that, I think, are reflected in the way, especially there's a story I wrote, Festival of Bulls, about a brother and sister, and the sister wants to wear the headscarf, and the brother's like, no, I'm going to beat it out of you. it's not a happy tale, but you know, he kind of represents a portion of Turkish political thought, which is sort of this misogyny. Turkey has done a really good job of politicizing women's bodies, both in favor and against women.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of context within Turkish politics that one has to understand to like really appreciate your stories, I think. Because one of the things when we read your stories for class, some people were confused about the surrealistic aspects of it, which you purposely put in to be more of a level playing field. Do you consider how to manage the expectations, I guess? Because I read an essay, it's called The 25 Essential Notes on Craft, which is all about how, you know, writing is about communication, right? So craft is just a set of expectations. And if people don't know the context or the expectations, and they're going to have trouble connecting to the writing. Do you ever think that that is like a major issue at all? Or do you think that, because these politics are definitely something that the average American audience is not right. going to know anything about, right? So do you ever consider that in the back of your mind when you're creating it? And do you ever try to solve it in your stories?
I do attempt to solve it in that I think I try. I don't know if I do a good job, but I try to be as politically expedient as possible with all of the background information necessary mm-hmm. for the particular story. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, with a story like Beolu Municipality Waste Management Orchestra, it's not super mm-hmm. important that you know exactly what Erdogan's policies are, but it is important that you understand right. it's a totalitarian state with watchers everywhere. So I try and get that information right. out pretty quick. And that's usually in the form of maybe a side mm-hmm. character or a little throwaway comment. Like, I didn't realize how dangerous it is to kind mm-hmm. of just have something these days. But, you know, I love that you bring up kind of craft and how what that means for your audience if an audience isn't aware of a literary tradition. And I think that I never considered it until after the book came out. And I think what that means is I have unfortunately kind of cornered myself into a niche. And I, you know, there's not mm-hmm. like, I could say like, oh, Americans, you should know more about church politics. But like, that's not fair. There's 180 yeah. some countries, right? How are you going to be responsible knowing
yeah.
all? And so what that means is that my audience doesn't have to be Turkish, but they get more out of it if they're aware of things. What that means is my audience is unfortunately a little more narrowed, but I don't think that that means that mm-hmm. there isn't something for everybody in there. Because otherwise you would only read books about right. your own experience. And so I think you grow. But mm-hmm. yes, it is difficult then, I think, to convince somebody to be like, hey, why don't you give this a shot, even though you don't know anything about Turkey? And I will say that the literary traditions, different literary traditions are more known in the States. So like, you know, we have the tradition mm-hmm. of oral storytelling through fairy tale. Grimm's brother, Hans Christian right. Andersen. And so if I wanted to write kind of a neo-fabulist tale, I could go that route and borrow mm-hmm. a little bit of that. And then more Americans would see kind of the tradition in it. Or I could go the route of Thousand and right. One Nights and maybe take a gamble.
Mm-hmm.
Although we are experiencing kind of a reappreciation for fairy tales from outside of the Western sphere. But
yeah.
it just depends on what you want the reader to experience. Do you want them to experience a fairy tale that they know, or do you want them to experience a new fairy tale? There's a big, and there is, they get to learn, there's a learning curve. And if they stick with me, I think, mm-hmm. I don't know. I wrote the stories, I can't too far away from them, but I think there's a payoff. I think it's worth it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's reminding me of, I don't know if you've ever read Louise mm-hmm. Erdrich, and like in Tracks, for example, it is the background politics of it is something we had to learn in class via mm-hmm. a presentation that a person wouldn't necessarily appreciate unless they actually have all the background information, which is, you know, definitely connected, mm-hmm. I think, to this issue. Do you ever find that maybe, because you do say you give the political part, try to get as expediently as possible. Do you ever find that people ever get confused between the what is absurdist and what is your political expediency? Because sometimes, yeah, like the whole banning right. of the books thing, sometimes in the Beolu one, sometimes people think like, that feels like that is absurdist, right? But it's like mm-hmm. a representation. So it's like, how much right. of it is real? You know,
it's kind of it's actually kind of a dangerous thing that I play with just because it feels like it cheapens the true sort of oppressions that occur. But I think readers like Andy Greer, who was very fortunate, very kind enough to blurb it, but then also selected one of them for the Best American. He knew a little bit about Turkish history. He's been there. He knows a number of Turkish writers.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of the ideal audience, of course, but he, you know, he doesn't know everything. And in talking with him, he was like, you know, it's really interesting to see someone come up with what's the next strange thing, but also what's feasible to happen to Turkey. And I do worry that right. kind of pushing that boundary might cheapen the real kind of atrocities, mm-hmm. but if it's only atrocities, I might as well be writing journalism, which, like, fair enough. There's really good yeah. journalism, especially before kind of the last 5 years, really good critical journalism coming yeah. out of Turkey.
Yeah.
It
but is, this
fiction.
Is fiction.
Exactly. And so I get to play
it.
A little bit more. I don't have to follow all the rules of truth. And so that means I can have stand-ins, like you
right.
say, with the book burning. Yeah, I could see Turkey burning mm-hmm. books. They haven't yet. But I could see the burning a lot of books.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So it's a balancing act.
You have like a stylistic choice, the ability to put more of our artisticness into it, right? Yeah. Which is sometimes people really enjoy that. I keep going back to Erdrich, but I remember we read a criticism of hers, which is like, you're too flowery. You're too much focusing on the literary artistic stuff, and you're not focusing enough on the atrocities. And it's like, people have such different ideas of how stories have
and
to
you
be.
Don't, right. The last thing you want to do is write this like really purpley story about, you know, maybe a war crime, and you're not really hammering home how horrible the war crime is. But I think that's what actually separates fiction from kind of nonfiction, is that fiction accepts that there is a war crime going on, but it's significantly more interested in the human experience of that war crime rather than the numbers, the statistical data, the atrocity in physical measurements. It's more interested in what Jim Shepherd calls the worm's eye view, which is, especially if you've read any of his short stories, things about like the Chernobyl accident from like the point of view of three brothers who can't stop bickering. So it's just like, that's what I think fiction does best. That's where it sings best, is where it uses the horror.
So zoomed in,
but the backdrop is, you know, perhaps World War II or Chernobyl or Turkey, modern day. But that's how you get, I think, the core, that empathy. That's how you get a reader. Because it is a lie at the end of the day. It's not true, but it's meant to feel it.
Right. It's in the name. It's fiction.
It's meant to feel like an experience.
Thank you very much for that. That was great. I really love that. I've learned a lot. But once again, thank you so much for being on this. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Culture Shocking Stories featuring Kenan Orhan. I hope you enjoyed, and I'll see you next time. Credits to the music can be found in the description.